Here's a sign of the times. A growing number of states require some sort of education and financial literacy in junior high school or high school. There's evidence that young people take financial literacy more seriously if it's presented in realistic terms. So many school systems are creating a kind of virtual visit to the world of credit cards and home loans and cable bills. As part of our series on financial literacy, NPR's Larry Abramson paid a visit to Finance Park in Fairfax County, Virginia.
Your minimum monthly payment is $861. The maximum you can pay is $1,148.
So could I get this one?
Fairfax County in the Washington, D.C. suburbs has plenty of shopping malls, but Finance Park is the only one exclusively for teenagers. Every eighth grader in this large suburban school system must show up at this mock-up of the real world, spend money, and act like an adult for a day.
I'm a single mom with an eight-year-old.
That's the identity that student Jackie Weir ended up. It's not her choice, just luck of the draw. She's earning good money, $82,000, but she still has to walk around to the furniture store, the supermarket, and she has to get a home loan from the bank. She must do all that and more without going over budget before she checks out of Finance Park in the afternoon. That won't be easy, since all these students are obsessed with one thing.
I'm buying a really expensive car. I have to pay almost $2,000 for it each month.
The need to save money is drummed into students at every turn, but that doesn't stop the fantasies. In fact, the brush with adulthood just seems to whet their appetites.
I wish I could buy a Lamborghini.
Well, you can't, because if you don't keep your budget in the black, you'll be sent back to go, and you won't get $200.
Triple play is a B&B, phone, internet, and TV.
Oh, these all are phone.
Yeah.
They both are. Oh, okay.
Volunteers try to help students sort through the same TV, phone, and internet bundles that drive average adults insane. The Verizon store looks like the real thing thanks to the self-interested generosity of the corporate sponsors who teamed up with Junior Achievement. That's the nonprofit group that helps educate young people about the world of business. If that makes this place seem like a product placement laboratory, that's part of the idea for Kristen Charnock, who teaches physics at Washington Irving Junior High School.
I think it brings some reality to it. I think it makes it more realistic to them. Some of the names they'll recognize and some they won't. But it's nice that they've designed the storefronts to make it look authentic.
And as grown-ups know, budgeting is not just a math exercise. David Van Vliet of the Fairfax County Schools says the point is to teach good decision-making.
These concepts are taught in civics classes. We teach taxes in mathematics courses. So they have these concepts that they're learning in school, but they need to see the practicality of those.
Many of these students say they had no idea about how tough it is for their parents to keep their suburban lifestyles on track. Student Lauren Caddington says when finances come up at her house,
they tell me to go out of the room.
So they don't tell you how much they make?
No.
You think that's bad? You think they should tell you?
Not really, because then I'd feel bad for, like, asking for things.
Which raises an important point. If this stuff is so important, maybe parents need to share more and discuss these things at home. Most kids told me they had fun in Finance Park, although much of the experience stresses how unfun it is to be an adult, how you can be earning good money and still be broke.
At this time, lunch for B, you need to throw everything away and exit the Burger King storefront.
Of course, Finance Park is not reality. Students are cut a lot of slack here. They only have to choose between baskets of food, not between hundreds of items with confusing food nutrition labels. They do not face the credit card hucksters and the used car dealers who will prey on them later in life. Here, if they enter the checkout line and find out that they screwed up their budget...
Oh, we forgot insurance. Can't drive your car without the insurance.
So I have to go back?
No, I'll do it right here.
Oh.
I have the power.
The kindly checkout clerk, one of the teachers, can rejigger the numbers and make it all better. There is some research indicating that this kind of thing works, that students come out of this whole process better prepared to spend and save smarter. The question is, will it stop them from buying into the next real estate bubble or from blowing their savings on a Lamborghini? Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The man who heads the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, spent the night in New York, but not at the kind of place he's accustomed to. Over the weekend, he was at a New York luxury hotel, the Sofitel. in a suite.
This morning he's at the Rikers Island Jail. Strauss-Kahn has been charged with 7 crimes, including attempted rape, sexual abuse, and unlawful imprisonment for his alleged attack on a maid at the hotel where he was staying. Yesterday, a judge denied bail to the 62-year-old, who until this past weekend was considered a front-runner for the presidency of France.
Strauss-Kahn's lawyers say he is innocent. Still, no matter what the outcome of the case, it's almost certain he will not remain head of the IMF. As NPR's John Itzde reports, that creates a considerable leadership vacuum at a delicate time for the global economy.
Dominique Strauss-Kahn's personal reputation may be irreparably harmed, but he created an impressive record of accomplishment at the IMF, says Ishwar Prasad, a former IMF official who's now a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Among senior international policymakers like finance ministers and central bank governors, Dominique Strauss-Kahn really had the status of a rock star.
Mohamed El Arian, CEO of PIMCO, the giant bond fund, says Strauss-Kahn was effective because of his political connections, his capacity to inspire, and his ability to seize opportunities.
And the financial crisis gave the fund an opportunity to start reasserting itself on the global stage, and Mr. Strauss-Kahn grabbed that opportunity.
Under Strauss-Kahn, the IMF's resources were multiplied, and its oversight of the world financial system was enhanced. But now, says El Arian, the allegations against Strauss-Kahn have put the IMF and the global economy at risk.
I think the risks for the global economy are definitely higher than they were before the news broke out on Saturday. The IMF is engaged in some very delicate issues around the globe, and without Mr. Strauss-Kahn, it's a different IMF.
Among those issues, the sovereign debt problems in European countries like Greece. Also, the need for the IMF's support in countries in the Middle East, like Egypt, which are undergoing fundamental transformations. Simon Johnson, a former chief economist at the IMF, is confident the institution's staff can still meet those challenges.
I think the short-term impact is actually quite limited. There is a lot of very good people at the IMF who are really on top of the details. And obviously, there are sensitive negotiations going on, for example, with Greece this week. But I think that they can certainly keep all the various balls in the air.
A White House spokesman says the Obama administration believes the IMF can continue to execute its mission effectively. John Lipsky, the deputy managing director of the fund, has been appointed to be interim leader. But Lipsky had previously announced he would leave the fund in August. Ishwar Prasad says that situation will create a ferocious battle between Europe and emerging market nations like China and India over who should lead the fund. In the past, the IMF's leaders have always been European, says Prasad.
And in fact, the German chancellor just fired the opening salvo in that battle, saying that right now there is a very good reason why the top job should once again go to European.
Presumably because of Europe's ongoing debt crisis. Prasad says Strauss-Kahn made sure conditions on the European debtors weren't too stringent. Simon Johnson, now a professor at MIT, says if an IMF leader were chosen from among emerging market country candidates, it could make things tougher for European debtors.
Their attitude, I think, would be less lenient than the leading Europeans.
That said, Johnson believes it is time for an emerging market candidate to be given an equal chance to lead the International Monetary Fund. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
The English language is definitely changing, but whether it's declining or evolving depends on whom you ask. Writer Robert Lane Greene recommends 3 books about what it means to speak and write well when the notion of well is a work in progress. It's for our series 3 Books, in which authors recommend 3 books on a single theme.
What makes books about the decline of traditional grammar and usage so popular? Works like Lynn Truss's Eat Shoots and Leaves lament the downfall of traditional punctuation standards, but there never was a golden age of language because language itself is in a constant state of flux. Yet we still pride ourselves on speaking and writing well, even when the definition of well is a moving target. These 3 books give some needed perspective to a lively and heated linguistic debate. The Power of Babel by John McWhorter takes us across dozens of tongues and thousands of years. We learn the process that turned the Romans femina, woman, into the modern French femme, shedding 2 syllables and even changing vowel sounds. But it's not all erosion and wearing down. McWhirter also shows how words can become more complicated over time, explaining, for example, where Italian verb endings come from. Seeing numerous languages laid out over history gives a valuable pause for those who mutter about decline. Languages don't decline, they change. Getting too attached to one moment in time is like getting too invested in the position of the goo in a lava lamp, McWhirter says. You can be bitter watching it shift, or you can be absorbed by the beauty in the process. So where do the rules that we traditionally associate with grammar come from? In some cases, millions of speakers drive the natural process of language change over centuries. But some so-called laws have a particular story and a single author, and Jack Lynch's book, The Lexicographer's Dilemma, fingers the culprits. It was 17th-century poet John Dryden who gave us the ban on prepositions at the end of sentences, though he announced this in mid-career after he had happily broken that rule earlier. The famous split infinitive was in vigorous use before an author known only as P was the first to prescribe it in a magazine in 1834. It doesn't seem possible to make grammar book writers memorable, but Lynch pulls it off with ease and gusto. A newly issued first edition of Henry Watson Fowler's Dictionary of Modern English Usage appeared in 2009, edited by linguist David Crystal. Fowler is magisterial and funny, opinionated but erudite enough to back up his dictates. The age of the book itself is a joy. It preserves now whiskery judgments such as his dislike of a curate's egg, something euphemized as good in parts but which is in fact thoroughly rotten. This, along with others, is listed under the headword hackneyed phrases. Crystal is a sure-handed interpreter. Though he holds Fowler in high esteem, he nonetheless puts his quirks and occasional misguided peeves in perspective. Crystal will help you understand how even the greatest sages of English usage can be wrong. There's nothing wrong with holding grammar in high regard, but much of the high dudgeon around it is more than a little bit of bunk. These books will help you approach writing and speaking not with anxiety or frustration, but with humility and a sense of wonder.
Robert Lane Green is a correspondent for The Economist and is the author of You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity.
You're listening to NPR.
We're going to hear next from a man who's working to understand Pakistan. That country often baffles outsiders. That's even more true after the discovery of Osama bin Laden near Pakistan's military academy.
For more than 20 years before bin Laden was killed, Anatol Levin studied Pakistan as a journalist and a scholar. He's spoken with everyone from soldiers to spies to people on the street. His new book, Pakistan, A Hard Country, is in many ways a sympathetic view, although Levin, too, is not sure how the Pakistani military failed to find bin Laden.
There is the possibility that their failure to catch him was due to incompetence. But what made me particularly suspicious was not that they would have been looking for him in the vicinity of a military base, but, you see, so many Pakistani military establishments have been attacked by Pakistani terrorists that this, it seems to me, was an absolutely obvious place for the military to search. And, I mean, one of the worst aspects of this whole affair from Pakistan's point of view is that it does make it more difficult for us to trust Pakistan.
There's a line in your book that seems particularly appropriate for the moment. You describe the relationship between Pakistan and the United States as a relationship of mutual exploitation, heavily flavored with mutual suspicion. What do you mean by that?
Well, both sides have benefited from the other very considerably in the past. The Pakistani military, it's true, has got a great deal of money from the US over the years. On occasions, America has got a great deal out of Pakistan. In the 1980s, it was, of course, the critical base to destroy the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. And since 9/11, it supplies most of its needs in Afghanistan via convoys through Pakistan. And the Pakistanis have been instrumental in arresting a considerable number of international terrorists.
Do we not really understand the country very well, not just when we talk about national security, but questions like corruption? Are we thinking about Pakistan the wrong way?
to some extent, we're not wrong to see corruption as a huge problem in Pakistan. What I think we perhaps don't understand is the degree to which corruption also maintains the stability of the system. Some of it, of course, comes straight back to bank accounts in London or New York, but a very large part of it is actually ploughed back into Pakistani society to buy political support. Of course, this does contribute to the stability of the existing political system.
Maybe what I'm thinking of here as you talk is old-style political machines in cities in the United States 100 years ago, where it was said that the political machine was terribly corrupt and raked money off the top and bought votes, but the people who sold their votes needed the money and they also expected services and they might have even gotten services in some cases.
Well, that's just it. I mean, Pakistan, I think, is more corrupt than America at its worst. But it wasn't even 100 years ago that people in Chicago said of Mayor Daley, he dunks but he splashes. And that is very much the attitude in Pakistan. Of course they take money for themselves, but they also splash a certain amount in our direction.
There has got to be some impulse in the United States at this moment to just be so disgusted with this relationship to want to walk away. Do you have any such impulse?
I think everybody who has ever dealt with Pakistan has had such impulses, sometimes several times a day. The problem is, however, the United States does depend on Pakistan for supply routes to Afghanistan. If we didn't have those, we'd have to be a lot nicer, not just to the Russians, but to some very nasty regimes in Central Asia, which would lead us into a whole different set of problems which might be just as bad as those of Pakistan. We do need Pakistani intelligence to go on pursuing international plots against the United States. And speaking as a Brit, of course, against Britain.
The American journalist Lawrence Wright, writing in The New Yorker the other day, reviewed the history of U.S. aid to Pakistan and essentially raised the question as to whether we had the incentives all wrong, because when there's a crisis, the U.S. shoves billions of dollars toward Pakistan. As soon as the crisis is over, we walk away. And he raised the question as to whether Pakistan then had a motivation to allow the problem with terrorism to go on and on and on, because that's how they get the money.
One does need to remember that at the last count, the Pakistanis had lost 3,500 soldiers and police in the fight against their own extremists. And they've lost more than 30,000 ordinary people on both sides, admittedly. This includes militants and militants' families, but still. So I don't think that Pakistan has an interest in keeping this crisis going. On that score, they have lost considerably more in economic damage due to the developing insurgency and terrorism than they have gained in aid from the United States. I mean, my view is that we need a consistent approach to the economic development of Pakistan. Where I do think we can and should bring pressure via aid is in aid to the Pakistani military.
Let's clarify this. There have been billions of dollars in U.S. aid to the Pakistan military in the last decade or so. There is beginning to be a flow that is supposed to eventually amount to billions of dollars in civilian assistance. It sounds like you'd like to continue the civilian assistance, but take another look at the military assistance.
That's precisely it. Unfortunately, it seems that America is heading in the opposite direction because, of course, the civilian assistance is controlled by Congress, and Congress is very angry with Pakistan. I mean, it's put in a whole set of conditionalities, which mean, in my view, that most will never be distributed. Of course, military aid is in the hands of the executive, and so that's how they go on essentially bribing Pakistan to cooperate. There is just one thing to be said, though, on this score, which is that perhaps Pakistan has an alternative. The Chinese have been making statements which suggest that if the US does cut back severely on aid, China might step up to the plate and replace the United States.
We've been asking about Western frustration with Pakistan. You get a sense of massive Pakistani frustration with the West. Do you think that Pakistanis would like to walk away from that relationship if they could?
Yes, I think they would. At least the masses in Pakistan would. With the elites, of course, it is complicated, and actually not just the elites, quite a lot of society. Because on the one hand, you know, as all the opinion polls show, and I can certainly testify, levels of anti-Americanism are among the highest in the entire Muslim world. On the other hand, of course, the Pakistani political elites have houses and apartments in London. So it is a curiously split relationship there.
Anatol Levin is author of the book Pakistan, A Hard Country. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Now to a financial crisis in this country where many towns and cities are struggling with severe budget deficits. In Rhode Island, the tiny town of Central Falls is on the edge of bankruptcy. Catherine Welch of member station WRNI says officials have few options in a place where many residents live below the poverty line.
Central Falls is only 1 square mile. That means there isn't a large tax base to cover the large demand for city services.
I feel terribly for them. It's awful that we're in this pickle.
That's Robert Flanders, Jr., the Rhode Island-appointed receiver running the city. Flanders is trying to convince a neighboring city to take over Central Falls, but he's running out of time.
So unless we get some relief on the cash flow problem, we're going to be in a crisis situation, even beyond what we're in now, sooner rather than later.
The pickle comes from the city's failure to do adequate fiscal planning. Retired police and firefighters may not get their pension checks starting in October. To boost revenues, Central Falls raised property and car taxes by 19%. But residents are barely scraping by, and so far many of them aren't coming up with the cash to pay their increased taxes. For NPR, I'm Catherine Welch.
At the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado this week, military veterans are getting ready for the second annual Warrior Games. Injured and ill servicemen and women, 220 in all, will compete in 7 different sports. NPR's Jeff Brady introduces us to one of the participants.
We're in a gym at Fort Carson, just outside Colorado Springs. There's a volleyball net in the center. It's hung low so it touches the floor.
Everybody's got different injuries, and some of the guys are double amputees, some are single amputees below the waist.
That's Savage Margraf. She's 24 years old and a member of the Marine Corps sitting volleyball team. Some of her teammates are the soldiers you've heard a lot about, injured by a roadside bomb or another combat-related injury. Others are accident victims or suffering from an illness. Sitting volleyball does not mean everyone is in a wheelchair. They're sitting on the floor and scooting around using whatever limbs they have to propel themselves.
The first day of practice, I was like, holy crap, this is really hard. Like, this is actually a sport where having legs is a disadvantage because they get in the way.
Margraf is one of the few who has both her arms and legs. She suffers from a traumatic brain injury that doctors attribute to a couple of bad falls she took while serving in Iraq. One was from a watchtower on the Syrian border.
And I was helping get a 50 cal barrel down. It's a machine gun. And we had to change out the barrels because there was a sandstorm. And I was helping one of the other guys do it. And as I was coming down the second stair from the top broke and I fell.
Now Margraf says she has trouble with her vision. She was medically retired in 2008 at 21 years old. Most of the people on this team appear to be in their 20s and 30s. Margraf says she also was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. She had surgery just a few weeks back.
I still have a pretty gruesome scar.
Margraf says she's feeling good now, though, certainly well enough to compete. Her teammate, Jesse Shagg, had his right leg amputated after a motorcycle accident in 2009. He played sitting volleyball in the first Warrior Games last year.
You know, you got 6 people on each side just trying to get the ball over the net.
The court is smaller than for standing volleyball. Still, Shagg says players move around a lot.
It's all about speed, and you got to have good hands. You got to be able to react with your hands on the floor and then bring them up to get the ball. So that'd probably be pretty difficult for most people.
Shagg is one of the designated setters for the team. He sets up the ball so someone else can slam it over the net. Everyone has a role, including Savage Margraf.
Oh, she's a great passer. She gets the ball to the setter almost every time she touches the ball.
So she's good at aiming then?
Yeah. She'll play the back row. She'll be one of the back 3 people, and she passes the ball great.
The Department of Defense and the U.S. Olympic Committee organized the Warrior Games. Margraf says the competition is fun, but she's really here for inspiration.
We have a swimmer that's double amputee and blind, and he's swimming. It's like, how can you not come to this and leave with some sort of motivation and know that there are people that are way worse than you and they are trying?
The Warrior Games continue through this week in Colorado Springs with the sitting volleyball finals on Saturday. Jeff Brady, NPR News.